You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. So, who are you going to believe, President Obama or your lying eyes? Nah, I don't mean it that harshly. President Obama gave a great talk this morning. He started out by talking about the guy who, it looks like, I mean, so far this looks like one of these workplace shootings, except that, you know, having an AR-15 handy certainly helped matters. We'll know more about that as time goes on, so I'm not going to go off on a long rant about the Navy Yard shooter. Other than that, we live down there, down near there. We live just about a half a mile up the river from there. And they shut down our marina. Fortunately, Louise and I went through the gate, you know, started walking on our way over to the TV studio for our first rundown meeting. It's about 10 o'clock this morning. And then we get this ping in our phone, and it's the marina sending a note to everybody who lives in the marina saying, the entire marina is on lockdown. Nobody can go in. Nobody can go out. Because, you know, stuff was happening in the Navy Yard, and they didn't know somebody might hop in a boat and hop out at our place. So, which reminds me of a story I've been wanting to tell you, but which I'm going to insert here before I get into this whole thing about the president saying the economy is getting better. And basically, you know, really the essence of his message, and I thought it was a shame that most all of the networks cut away from him once he was done talking about the Navy Yard shooting, because he had a pretty good message. But the essence of his message was, why isn't Congress doing something to make things better? The answer, of course, is simple. Because you're president. And they want you to fail. I mean, you know, Mitch McTurtle has been saying this since literally day one. But anyway, last night, Louise and I, some people that we met a week ago, every Sunday morning there's this captain's coffee, it's called. Like, there's no captain, right? And on our marina, there's a little floating dock and a, you know, with a barbecue pit and a picnic table. And so every Sunday morning, people get together there and Roger brings down his coffee pots and plugs them in, and people just walk by and drop, you know, from around 9 until around 11 and socialize. And it's potluck, you know, bring your own stuff. And occasionally you get in a marina what are called transients, people who are just passing through. You know, they come in and they pay the daily fee to tie up and use the electricity or whatever. And these folks actually weren't tied up in the marina. They were parked out in the channel, you know, anchored out in the channel where you don't have to pay anything. And they had a sailboat, a little Gemini, catamaran style sailboat. And so last night, I won't use their last names, last night Irwin came over and we met them at the captain's coffee. They were just there, and it was like, hey, how are you? And Judy had listened to my program for years, and so it was like, hey, how, you know, oh, you? And so last night they came over and took us out to their sailboat. It's 100, consider. She's from San Diego, he's from Detroit. He, back, I don't know, 21 years ago, sold a Jewish deli in Detroit and bought this boat and has sailed it up and down the Mississippi, up and down the East Coast, up and down the West Coast, took it through the Panama Canal, went over to San Diego, met her. These are people who are on Medicare. I mean, they're over 65, and they're not retired. I don't want to say they're retired. It's like they're just like living a really good life, but their boat is, I mean, this is a fairly old, but this is not, my point is, these are not people of great wealth. And the people I keep meeting these people who are like living on sailboats, traveling around the world. Before Judy and Irwin, we met Bill and Sue N, who is another couple, and they know each other. And they had come through in a sailboat, and they're sailing all over the world. And he is a retired, I believe, police officer or an administrator in a police department. He's on a police pension. And so it's like, and or, you know, people, you know, living on Social Security and Medicare. and they're traveling around the world just having a good time. So the boat is very, you know, it's very small. I mean, just like, well, ours is quite small too. And, but it's 100% solar powered, 100% wind powered. This is how they've gotten all over the world, by wind power, right? You put up a sail. The only electricity they have is solar power, a couple of solar panels on the roof, and, you know, a recycling toilet. It's a totally green. It's just, I'm just, you know, I'm really impressed. There's some people who are just, and just, you know, like Bill before, who came before, you know, he just decided he wanted to do this after he retired with his pension from the police department, as I recall. And sometimes we meet people in their 30s or 40s who, because you've got to have the basically somewhere between $25,000 and $100,000 to buy the boat, right? And then once you got that, you know, life can be very, very cheap. I mean, you know, they were telling us about living, you know, visiting, I forget if it was Costa Rica or Panama, but, you know, spending $9 a night for hotel rooms and things like that. And, you know, just you can live inexpensively traveling around the world. It's just cool. So anyway, so the president comes out today and he says, you know, essentially pay no attention to that economic disaster that we're in the middle of, except, you know, or, you know, he pointed out correctly, things are getting better. But they're not well. And instead, what's going on is the Republicans are doing everything they can to sabotage him. I mean, the sequester. John Boehner said, yeah, I got 95% or 98% of everything I wanted. That was the sequester. Remember when Boehner said that? Yeah. This all goes, and now the New York Times over the weekend is reporting. We're trying to get the oil companies to put more renewable energy stuff into their gasoline, into your gasoline. And they're doing it by saying that you've got to have a certain amount of ethanol, and if you don't have the ethanol, you have to buy energy credits from companies that use more ethanol than they need to, and so they get surplus energy credits. The government issues the credits. So there's this like little market between companies and these ethanol credits, so that company A that's not quite up there yet, company B that's like 10% ahead of the curve, company B can sell their credits to company A. It's kind of like a cap and trade system. And that one of these companies, I think it was Valero, was the one that was quoted in the New York Times. They said, you know, okay, we need to buy some energy credits, and we can't find any. And J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, Jamie Dimon comes along and says, oh, I'd be glad to sell you some. We've got hundreds of millions of them. Seriously, they originally sold for 7 cents apiece, as I recall. Let me get my exact, 7 cents. That's what the government sold the energy credits for, 7 cents apiece. And J.P. Morgan says, we'll sell them to you for $1.43 each. So the oil companies, they got no choice. They got to buy them, right? So they buy them for $1.43, and guess what they do? They add it to your gasoline price. And Jamie Dimon sticks the money in his pocket. You wonder why these banksters are getting rich? It's like Congress didn't anticipate the banksters getting into the ethanol credit business. But they did. They're here. We got a really serious problem with our banksters in this country. After the break, I'm going to lay the whole thing out from beginning to end, where it started, how it got worse, how it is now. And then I'm going to offer some solutions. And if you've got any solutions or just observations, or if you've ever lived on a sailboat, give me a shout. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Living on a sailboat seems really cool. Tight, but cool. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, back to the, this is great. I got a couple of callers about living on boats and RVs. We will, and my apologies, Kelly, John, and others, we will get to you in about 10 minutes. So just hang on the line, please. I hope you have unlimited minutes. Or call back. because I want to go through this banking thing. The president was talking about this morning, and the thing that and to the bottom of the hour, and then we'll after the break we'll pick up the calls. But a couple of interesting milestones. Okay, over the weekend, Larry Summers, who had been the Treasury Secretary during Bill Clinton, big cheerleader for Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and all this stuff that Ken Lay was wanting passed through Congress and you know, his toady Phil Gramm passed. Larry Summers said after everybody, I mean, Bernie Sanders said it on this program on Friday, I will not vote for Larry Summers. At that point, Larry Summers just said, okay, enough already. I'm not, you know, take me out of the running. So now we'll see. I mean, unless the president has got some kind of personal animus against Janet Yellen, who is the number two person at the Fed, she may be the first female director of the Fed, chairman of the Fed, chairwoman of the Fed. And she actually seems to be a fairly well-qualified person who's got a lot of support from people like Paul Krugman, whose credentials and perspectives I have a lot of respect for. So I don't claim to have any personal knowledge of her, but we'll see how that goes. So how did this all happen? How did we get to this disaster point? Back in 1920, the economy had been kind of puttering along, but back in 1920, Warren Harding ran for president. And Warren Harding said, I have the thing that will stimulate the economy. I am going to give you an economy like no other economy you ever saw before. Really simple. Here it is. And it became, this was the bumper sticker. This was the slogan for his presidential campaign in 1920. He was Republican, of course. And the slogan was, more business in government, less government in business. In other words, let's privatize business and let's stop regulating business. Let's privatize government and stop regulating business. He won. The Republicans did it. And so you had three consecutive Republican administrations. You had Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and what was Hoover's first name? Herbert. That's right. Herbert Hoover. So here you got these three guys from 1920 until 1929. And they kicked off what was referred to as the Roaring Twenties, because they basically deregulated the banksters, they deregulated everybody, and they said, we'll look the other way, have fun. And you had people on the stock market, you had a huge bubble in the stock market, and you had a huge bubble in the housing market. And the one in the housing market actually was driving most things. It started down in Florida, and it just spread all up and down the country. And then that burst in 29, and everybody kind of took a serious, sober look at what happened for the next 3 years during the Hoover administration. And then Franklin Roosevelt came in and said, okay, let's clean this mess up. He said, rule number one, banks that sell stocks, banks that gamble on their own accounts or on behalf of their customers, those banks can no longer be called banks. They're brokerage houses. I mean, you can call them banks. We'll call them investment banks, but they're not really banks. You can't have a checking account with one. You can't have a savings account with one. They don't write mortgages. They don't loan money to businesses. They just do gambling. And they're not protected by the federal government. No FDIC protection. No guarantees. They get in trouble? They got in trouble. Investors get in trouble? Hey, that's one of the risks of being an investor. On the other hand, the bank that holds your checking account and your savings account, that bank cannot gamble with stock, either on behalf of you or on behalf of itself. It especially can't use your money to gamble on stock for itself. And we call these commercial banks because they do the business of commerce, right? They're part of our infrastructure. And the law that made that the law of the land was called Glass-Steagall. It was passed 1935. Senators Glass and Steagall, I guess. Pardon me, I'm sneezing. So, Glass-Steagall came along. Yep, Glass-Steagall got passed. And up until 1935, when Glass-Steagall had been passed, from the George Washington administration to the Franklin Roosevelt administration, we had never gone more than 15 years in the history of the United States without a national bank panic. Most of them weren't as bad as the Great Crash of 29, but there had never been a period longer than 15 years without a bank panic. And it was because banks were gambling. And they were gambling very often with the money of their depositors. So when you put your money in the bank, there was always a risk. And when the bank went belly up, you lost everything. So Roosevelt said, we're going to do two things. One, we're going to separate these two kinds of banks. And two, we're going to offer federal insurance for the small depositors in the commercial banks, FDIC. From 1935 until 2008, there wasn't a single bank panic. Not one. Because of Glass-Steagall. So what happened? Well, first of all, Reagan came along and stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 82. So that in 99 and 2000, when the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and Graham-Leach-Bliley were passed, which respectively allowed banks to gamble even on commodities that previously hadn't existed, like speculation on mortgage loans, and Glass-Steagall was put to death, when those two things happened, the banksters just started gambling like crazy. So we saw this boom. Now, 70 years of New Deal economics, we had had a fairly stable and mature mortgage market. But they had figured out a way to make literally millions of dollars off a $100,000 mortgage by selling bets on bets on bets. And so they wanted as many mortgages as they could get. They didn't even care if they were good. So we had this period from 2000 until 2008, basically the Bush presidency, when $900 trillion worth of derivatives were created on the back of a couple hundred billion dollars, or perhaps less than that, of bad mortgages. And it all came crashing down in 2008. The problem has not been fixed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So this administration has sort of gotten us out of the crisis. But they're papering this thing over with paper mache and baling wire. It is not fixed. Another mass shooting, this time in the nation's capital. The guy with an AR-15, a civilian gun that can shoot lots and lots of rounds. 12 people dead, including the shooter. Only in America, right? Well, I mean, it has happened in other countries, but we seem to have a lot of it. This latest study that came out last week showed more guns, more deaths, more homicides, more suicides, more homicides. Very simple. There's a very simple correlation between the two. More guns you have in a society, the more people are going to get shot. Gee, what a surprise. More cars, more car accidents. You think? More cows, more cow tipping? Could it be? I don't know. Cow tipping is supposed to be impossible. But I have two staff members right here, Shane and Danielle, who both say they've seen it happen. And yet Andrew, our senior producer over on the TV show, he said that he scoured the YouTube sphere and couldn't find a single video of a cow being tipped. So who knows? Anyhow, what would you do to fix the economy? I would basically roll back the Clinton administration and the Reagan administration, the deregulation of the Clinton administration, the deregulation of the Reagan administration, the tax cuts of the Reagan administration. Larry Summers pulling out was the second act in what I think is a three-act play. And then I'm going to pick up your phone calls. Let me just say this. The three-act play that we have seen played out literally just in the past few weeks was, first, Americans said, you know that Bush administration thing, the Bush doctrine, preemptive war, all that kind of nonsense? That's crap. We don't want that anymore. We're over it. That's nonsense. It's stupid. You want to try that in Syria? No. And, you know, thankfully, John Kerry and Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Putin were able to work something out, at least so far. Time will tell. So number one, people said, Bush administration, no, we're not going to go back there. Number two, people said, Clinton administration, we're not going to go back there either. And this was Larry Summers. Larry Summers was the Treasury Secretary under the Clinton administration. He was the guy, he was like the head guy in charge of deregulating the banksters. He was the head guy in charge of the whole. I mean, you know, he basically set up the whole disaster, the crash of 2008, that we are still in the middle of. That was Larry Summers. On Sunday, he said, okay, don't put me in as the Fed, because all these Democratic senators are coming out, and Bernie Sanders said this on this program on Friday, all these Democratic senators are coming out and saying, no, Clinton administration was wrong when it came to economics. The third act of this three-act play is going to be played out in the next couple of months, and I predict it's going to go the same way. President's going to come forward thinking, hey, I can do this. Everybody will love this. It's just Bill Clinton all over again, which was Syria, right? Oh, we're going to do in Syria the same way that we did in Bosnia. We'll get the Senate to vote for it. We'll go in. We'll do some bombing. The House will probably vote against us, but it'll be all over and done with, and everything will be fine. I genuinely think Obama thought he was going to, you know, just follow the Clinton playbook and it would work out just fine. The American people said, no, we don't like that. And then Obama thought he was going to follow the Clinton playbook and put Clinton's Treasury Secretary in as the head of the Fed. After all, the Clinton administration saw all this job growth, right? Bubble. And the American people said, no, we don't want to do that either. The next one's going to be the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the next big free trade deal. And I think that Obama believes that he's going to roll this thing out and people are going to go, oh, yeah, free trade deals. Bill Clinton brought those. NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, WTO, GATT, all that stuff. Yeah, things are just fine. Sure, go ahead. Mr. President, you know, if you're doing what Bill Clinton did, we like it. And I think he is so out of touch on this. Just like he was on Syria and just like he was on Larry Summers. So to my friends at the White House who listen to this program to see how seditious I'm going to get, let me just say, you know, somebody might want to whisper in his ear. If you want Democrats to win the election in 2014 and in 2016 to win the White House, and in fact, Hillary Clinton should begin campaigning on this right now, oppose the TPP. Don't promote it. And for that matter, start talking about pulling out of NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, and all those others, because they are not helping us. Let's go back to a protectionist, tariff-based, rational, or if you can get the courage out of Congress, you know, a VAT tax-based, because this is how the European countries do it. But let's go back to a trade policy that doesn't require monetary policy to determine how bad our trade deficit is going to be. Because our trade deficit with China is a little, or our trade deficit in general is a little better this year. With China, it's worse than ever before, but we're importing less oil because of all the natural gas from fracking, which is a whole other set of problems. But this is no way to run an economy. So we'll see how that the three-act play plays out. So anyhow, Kelly, in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, you grew up on a boat?
Well, yeah, I grew up in Huntington Harbor on a boat, and I was the only kid that could go to school on Monday. And when other kids asked, what did you do this weekend, I told them I took my house to Catalina.
Huh. Really?
Yeah, it was great. We lived on a boat for 8-9 years.
Yeah.
And,
now, the thing that I'm noticing, I mean, I live in the public marina here in D.C., and next door to us is the yacht club. At where Larry Craig has his boat. What I've discovered, I mean, there's a couple of boats down from us, a young couple, they just had their first baby, you know. I mean, it's like it is a profile of middle America. Most of the people who live in our marina are not even close to the 1%. There's a lot of pensioners, it's not the lifestyles of the rich and famous. There's some of that down at the yacht club, but even at the yacht club, it's not so much the lifestyles of the rich and famous as much as you'd think it would be, you know. Were you living more of a middle class life and people had figured out how to do it on a boat, or was it more of the lifestyles of the rich and famous?
No. This was middle class. My parents were truck drivers. They owned a trucking company paving roads and hauling sand and gravel in Southern California.
Wow. And you lived on a boat.
So
what was the boat?
Yeah. We weren't so green friendly. They were diesels. It was twin 220 Volvos in it, and it was a 45-foot aft cabin.
Yeah, but that's similar to what Louise and I live on. You know, we live on a 46-foot Chris Craft Constellation. But it was built in 1986, and we've never taken it out in the 2 years we've lived on it. So we don't burn any diesel fuel. What can I say?
Right.
It's basically our house.
I do have a side note for you, Tom.
Yeah.
I really honestly believe that 2014 is going to surprise you more than you believe.
You think that there's going to be a Democratic wave or a Republican wave?
No. I have friends that are Democrats, that are Republicans, that are independents. And out of all of the different groups, the Republicans, they won't even discuss anything anymore. They are completely defeated.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they don't care about, they don't want to talk anything about politics. They don't want to, they are just completely defeated.
Yeah. Well, Kelly, from your lips to God's ears, let's hope that's the case. I want to get on. We got a whole bunch of callers here on a variety of topics and boats to Herbert Hoover. So, Kelly, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And John in La Crescenta, California. Hey, John.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Thank you.
I moved into an RV after a divorce to try to save some money.
Uh-huh.
And it was going to be temporary, and now it's 6 years.
Wow.
And,
so you're doing the kind of land version of what our friends on the sailboat are doing.
Yes, indeed, sir. And I've gotten very used to it, and I rather enjoy it because I have no landlord. I'm in a membership campground, so I don't have any utility bills. It costs me $560 a year, and I essentially have unlimited camping.
Wow.
And I can go visit my kids and bring my house with me.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting to see the change in the dynamic over the 6 years of people moving into these places because, you know, a lot more retirees are doing it, and I suspect the economy is somewhat behind it.
Yeah.
And right now I have no intention of saving my life or changing my lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place to live. It's well kept up and I have no complaints at all and I don't I'd be paying three times as much money for a dump in Crenshaw as I would be paying
For us it was the same thing with the economics. I mean, our slip fees, you know, we pay $500 a month and that gets us cable TV and electricity and sewage and water and a place, you know, to live. And our rent before that was, multiples of that, shall we say. And that was for a relatively modest apartment, but it's in Washington, D.C. So it's like I think people don't get it, that there are inexpensive ways to live, you know, in a wide variety,
yep,
of places. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I love listening to you debate people from the other side of the aisle because you don't interrupt them. You don't talk over them. It's an intelligent debate, and then they say their piece, you say your piece, and unlike the Rush Limbaughs of the world.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for sharing your story of living in an RV. We've got this little tiny shower and a little tiny kitchen and a little, you know, it's I kind of know what we probably have a similar experience. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, it looks like the rest of our callers have ways to save the economy. So we will get to that right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jerry Bell with AM760 in Denver, our affiliate in Denver, our Clear Channel affiliate, is on the line to share with us what's going on there with the flooding. Jerry, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you. So what's the latest status report on the flooding in Colorado?
Well, the good news is as I look out my window here, I can see blue sky, and we haven't seen that in Colorado for about 3 or 4 days, at least for any extended amount of time.
Uh-huh.
To give you an idea, we don't really have a damage total for all the affected areas just yet. But in Larimer County, where the big Thompson River flooded, here's the tab that they've preliminarily established. 1,500 homes destroyed, another 4,500 damaged, 200 businesses destroyed, another 500 believed to be damaged. That's just in one county.
Wow. And you say home destroyed, and then think about your own home and, you know, the loss of the pictures of your lifetime and the papers of your lifetime and the mementos and all. I mean, it's just, wow.
I should point out, too, that these aren't just homes that were built right next to the river and things like that. The flooding has been so vast. In fact, in Larimer County, they're saying some of the areas there were hit by what they call a 1,000-year flood, which means once every 1,000 years you would get a flood like this. So what we're also going to see here in Colorado is a lot of people who got hit by these floodwaters who do not have flood insurance, and they're going to have to go through the FEMA route to get assistance.
Whoa. And any word on how that's going?
It's going actually really well. I just attended a briefing with FEMA. They've actually done a pretty good job of mobilizing resources here. And they had, in fact, supply houses, caches of water, foods, other kinds of supplies. And they already had those coming to Colorado before they were requested. And now what they're looking at doing is something that they learned after Hurricane Sandy, is looking at damaged homes and seeing if, with some repairs, that people could go back to their homes and at least live there rather than do the whole FEMA trailer thing.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, I'm glad they're learning from experience. Now that Brownie's gone, it's like there's a whole new world of possibility. But I realize you don't want to get into the politics. You're not the politics.
Well, yeah, what they found is that in doing that's cheaper than giving everybody, cutting them a check to go find some place to live in
a
rental. But we're probably going to have some of those kind of trailers or some kind of temporary housing, because the floodwaters now are moving out onto the eastern plains of Colorado, and those are really small towns that are right up next to the South Platte River, and, they don't have places where you can go rent a place to stay and things like that. If people want to stay in and around their community, they're going to have to come up with some kind of temporary housing. But in some of the larger areas that where it come off the foothills along the Front Range of Colorado, those places, they're giving people checks and some money to find a place to stay. And as I said, they're looking to see if they can repair damage and get people back into their homes.
It's good to know it's working out. Jerry, I doubt you're a meteorologist, but do you know what the weather system or how this came about? Was it like, a giant front collides with a something, I don't know.
It's a weird coincidence of things that happened. It's a case where fronts came through one on top of the other, kind of a thing,
right,
and things got stalled. In Colorado, normally, especially here on the Front Range and Eastern Plains, we've been in a drought, as I think a lot of people are aware. So usually in the summertime, we get a thunderstorm, it lasts for an hour, and it moves on.
Right.
This was a case where it just parked over this area and just kept raining and raining and raining. And then in addition to that, we had some severe weather, huge amounts of hail in parts of the Metro Denver area, even flooding in some of our drainage canals and things like that. In Boulder, which took a really bad hit, they are now saying that they got 21 inches of rain out of the system. That's about what they normally get in a year.
And they got it in 24 hours.
They got in a week.
In a week. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That is remarkable. That is remarkable. And are they expecting more rain?
Fortunately, the forecast today, we might have a few thunderstorms, but these heavy rain and downpours that we've seen, those are going away. And over the next week, maybe well into the weekend, we're looking at a dryout period. Much welcomed here, to be sure.
Okay. Jerry Bell from AM 760. It's KZZN, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
You betcha.
Jerry Bell. Thank you so much, Jerry.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the report. Great talking with you. Tim in Ludington, Michigan. Tim, listening to WCPT, you had some thoughts on the Hoover and Coolidge administrations, maybe lessons for today?
First of all, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Much appreciated. Hey, driving home, I was listening to what you're saying, and I teach economics in high school, and a PBS video, and it's called The Crash of 1929. And in it, it talks about five men who controlled the markets. They manipulated them.
Mm-hmm.
There was Meehan, I think Mitchell, Durant, Livermore. I can't remember the fifth one. But what they would do, Meehan was he controlled RCA. They would buy their own stock at a low, alarming rate, and then they would pay off a couple of journalists to put this in the paper that these stocks are selling like crazy. So John Q. Public would start buying it and artificially with a certain price, and then they would dump all the stock that they of their own that they bought, and they'd make out like a bandit and then just continue to do this over and over again.
Yeah. This is a deal that they've been doing with penny stocks for years and years. It's called pump and dump.
Yeah. And, you know, they controlled the market for a good part of the 20s. And yeah, it's a very interesting video on PBS if you get a chance to watch it. It's called the Crash of 1929. Yeah. But, you know, and, you know, I live here in Michigan under Rick Snyder. You know, I was frightened to death what would happen if Romney would have been elected. And but sadly, we're living it here in Michigan.
Oh, yeah. Did you see it down in Detroit? They shut down power to the city because he wanted, you know, the emergency manager's number right hand guy made the decision to cut off power to the city for a few hours to Detroit on the hottest day of the year on 9/11. And he said to teach them a lesson. Really? And the lesson, of course, is that they're trying to privatize Detroit's electric system.
They're trying to privatize the whole state now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Tim, thanks a lot for the call from Ludington and for listening to the show. We'll be back. It's coming up on 4 o'clock here on the East Coast. And we'll be back with Brian McNichol from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's going to try and tell us why the D.C. mayor did the right thing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Okay, so the Washington, D.C. City Council, by a, 7-4 vote, whatever it was, 7-5 vote, I think, by a majority vote, voted that if you are a big store, if you do over $1 billion a year in business, if you've got over, I think, 40,000 square feet in your store, you have to pay a living, and you want to do business in Washington, D.C., you have to pay $12.50 an hour, a living wage in this city, which is arguably not even a living wage, but it's a starting point. 71% of D.C. voters support this. It's called the Large Retailer Accountability Act. 63% are more likely to vote for the mayoral candidate who supports the bill, by the way. This is a new poll. It just came out like yesterday from Hart Research, which is not a, you know, not one of these like Fox News places or, for that matter, MSNBC places. And tomorrow at noon, there's going to be a big rally on the front steps of the Wilson Building to support an override of Mayor Gray's veto of this bill, because he vetoed it last week. And if they can get one more vote, actually two, I guess they've got to get two votes to override Vince Gray's veto, then they will have it. Brian McNichol is on the line. He's a senior communications director of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So
just a couple of things about what you said. It's one vote. They only need one. It was 8-5 the first time. If they can get to 9-4, they would override.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And so my question, I know that you're supporting Mayor Gray in having overridden this or vetoed this vote, and that you're opposed to the Large Retail Accountability Act. And what I don't understand is why you don't like democracy. That's a genuine question. The majority of people in the city want this. The majority of their elected officials voted for it and passed it. That's called the democratic process. You're opposed to that. Why would you be opposed to the democratic process?
Well, the mayor vetoed it. He was elected by those people, too. And I guess they'll all have to stand before the voters and see where all this ranks and what the voters find important.
But isn't that really the core issue, that, you know, communities establish the rules by which business operate, whether it's building standards or, you know, the number of parking lots you got to have or, you know, zoning, whatever. Communities get to establish the rules by which business operate. And here's a community, Washington, D.C., saying we don't want to repeat the mistake that Chicago made 3 years ago when they let Walmart in over the, you know, again, they, the city council of Chicago tried to keep them out. Their mayor,
a mistake in Chicago.
Their mayor vetoed that.
Stores running there now.
They have done a study. Yeah, there have been several studies now on what happened after Walmart came into Chicago, and what they found is that it did not create any new jobs. It put out of business a lot of local retailers, and it lowered the average wage.
I mean, I don't know how you can say that, or I haven't seen these studies, so I really can't speak to them. But so I don't understand the question.
Let's see here. I've got one in my hand, and 82 of 306, after a single Walmart opened in Chicago in September of 2006, 82 of the 306 small businesses in the surrounding neighborhood had gone out of business by March of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
What they found was Walmart store openings kill three local jobs for every two they create by reducing retail employment by an average.
How do they establish the causality?
By reducing retail employment by an average of 2.7% in every county they enter. You just count the number of people who are working. Walmart's entry into a new market does not increase overall retail activity or employment opportunities. A research from Chicago shows retail employment did not increase in Walmart's zip code and fell significantly in those adjacent. Supermarkets and discount variety stores are the most adversely affected sectors, suffering sales declines of 10 to 40% after Walmart moves in. There's more. I mean, I got, you know, several pages of this. Plus Walmart cost the taxpayers $245 million just in 2008 by paying rent to itself and then deducting that from its taxable income, something that a local business would not be able to do. They'd be, you know, paying rent to somebody else who would then have to declare that as income. And, for instance, in Ohio, Walmart has more associates and associates dependent on Medicaid than any other employer, costing taxpayers an estimated $44 million just in 2009. And, you know, so basically we all subsidize Walmart because they pay 28% below the average for big box stores. And so their employees are more likely to be on food stamps and on other aids to, you know, low income people. So we're supporting their business model. Why should we, what's wrong with saying we don't want to support this kind of a predatory, what's the word for a bloodsucker? parasitic business model.
Well, what's going to happen on the day Walmart says show up today to apply for the jobs?
Well, it's going to be a lot of people, but that would be true if
market,
anybody had...
It is a good wage.
No, that's not true. It's got nothing to do with the marketplace. It's got to do with the fact that our trade policies in this country since the middle of the Clinton administration have devastated the job market. We lost 56,000 factories from 2000 to today.
Well, they're talking about adding 2,400 jobs at $10 an hour, right?
Yes.
Here in town.
Yes.
And
well, they're not
$10 and $12. It's between $10 and nothing because Walmart's not going to open the stores if the.
But if they had 1,200 jobs and that causes local employers who aren't as efficient and therefore hire more people to lay off 1,600 people, which is basically the math that I just shared with you from Chicago, it might look good the first day that they open their doors, but if you look over a 2-year period, it's a disaster. Why do that?
Well, won't so 2,400 people will get jobs. People all over the city will get groceries. See, that's a big problem in D.C. You're not going to be displacing a lot of groceries because there's not a lot of groceries.
Well, the free market has taken care of that. Safeway, this is how Louise and I get most of our groceries. They've started this thing called Peapod. And you go online on
there. Has Peapod, but
right. Yeah, so
I understand that. But
I mean, everybody in the city that I know gets, or not everybody, but
the low middle income people do not use Peapod, right?
Well, there are increasingly stores around town, but I'm with you. I would like to see policies in Washington D.C. that encourage the kind of, you know, corner green grocers that you have in Manhattan. It's just that the gentrification of New York City has been so intense. Since the boom in the lobbying business in this town. I mean, when Reagan came into office, you had 300 plus registered lobbyists in this town. Now you've got over 32,000 and the starting pay is around $170,000 a year for them. And there's so much money in this town that it's just, impossible to because grocery stores run on a fairly low margin. It's impossible to find, you know, a couple thousand square feet on a street corner where you could open a grocery store. That's a bad thing. And that's, again, where I think, you know, the market has failed us, and government should step in and say to developers, if you're developing a city block, you've got to have room for a grocery store.
But here's somebody willing to build you six stores if you don't put them at a path of law that affects one business in town. Now, you know, Walmart, if they open these stores, will not be the only business in town that makes a lot of profit but doesn't pay its employees very much, right? And there's any number of restaurants, lobbying people, think tanks, there I said it, where people, you know, people at the top make more money than the people at the bottom, right?
Yeah, but I don't think at think tanks, unless you're talking about interns, people are paid $10 an hour. Are they? I mean, you work for one.
We have our interns.
Tell me. I don't know.
$10 an hour.
Yeah. Well, that's what I said, you know, other than interns. Okay. Well, it's an interesting conversation, and we'll see how our listeners weigh in. Brian McNichol, Senior Communications Director over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI. Brian, thanks for dropping by today.
All righty.
Always nice talking to you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So 71% of D.C. voters want Walmart to at least pay $12.50 an hour. Shouldn't they? Shouldn't they? Minutes past the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And why should community? Why would conservatives? You know, I never actually got a good argument out of Brian about that. Why would conservatives say that a community should not be allowed to set their own wage policies? Why? Don't get it. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark.
You want to play level the playing field for the middle class, Tom? We need organized labor back.
Oh, yeah.
Unions.
Yeah, you know how to start that is do away with Taft-Hartley.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what we need, Tom, is a vision and a movement from the labor parties, or not labor parties, but the AFL-CIO and all the other unions, and do an all-out organizing campaign in this country and organize workers again. That's the best way to get this economy and the middle class back. That's what Reagan destroyed here.
Yeah. The big problem with that, Mark, is that when you have a tight labor market, when there's about as many people looking for jobs as there are employers looking for workers, or when you have a very tight labor market, when you have more employers are looking for workers and they can't find them, then it's not only easy for a labor union to emerge, but it's almost a natural thing. But on the other hand, when you have a very, very loose labor market, it's a lot harder to maintain a labor union without government backing, because the non-union employers, like Walmart's a great example, will simply say, hey, we don't need no stinking union here. If somebody wants to work here, they can work here. If they don't, they don't have to. And as soon as they open the doors, they'll get 10 applicants for every job, or maybe even 100 applicants for every job, because the labor market is, there's so much slack. It's such a loose market. And that's why it's going to take more than just an organizing action. It's going to take the force, the power of government to say that democracy in the workplace has legal protections. And that means rolling back Glass-Steagall, undoing the right to work for less, the ability of states to become right to work for less states, because that's just union busting pure and simple. Mark, thank you for your call. Excellent point. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up? Armin, you are on the air.
Let me go just a bit, please, because you and I really go back.
I beg your pardon?
Tom?
Yes?
Let me go just a little bit with this, because you and I both go back. Your dad was a tool and die maker. My dad built racing engines and worked as a satellite, so to speak, for the progress of Mercury outboards for 45 years. So, I mean,
good
I can
him.
Tell you a lot of things that you can relate to, and I've seen it in a small Midwestern town I grew up, where we had unions and we were consuming 95% of what we consume was made in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that you can have a sustainable, non-spiraling, non-inflationary rise of the middle class and all the boats of the middle class working people without PhD degrees is value-added manufacturing, to where you take somebody that doesn't have too much education, you put them to work, labor, sweat, they take 10 cents worth of natural resources and make something that's worth $5 or $3, and you pay them a buck and a half to do it. That's how this country became rich. It took us 200 years to get to the point where China got to the same point in 40 years with all our dirty manufacturing jobs, all those jobs that we didn't want. We were going to service. They didn't do it with the think tanks and the universities and the PhDs and the tenured professors. They did it with sweat, equity, value-added manufacturing.
They're singing my song, Armin.
Crashing right now. They're sustaining our capital. And what I'd like to say is the only way that I can see that we're going to get back and get back to where we were, where we have a middle class again, we're going to have to bring the factories back. It's not fair that Americans compete with robots in other countries or slaves or people that aren't free. That is the most absurd argument I've ever heard. And these crime syndicate representatives in Washington that sell the plan that's completely stripped out our middle class, which is NAFTA, WTO, World Trade, all these gimmicky things. When they look at the mathematical equation, they look at it as a static application. It's not a static application because it's not permanent, because it evolves and slowly moves along and has huge equity changes and factors economically and socially that affect the equation, and they don't tell the whole story.
Armin, I'm completely with you. That's why I said I think that we're watching this three-act play right now, and we're watching it in a relatively short period of time. We're going to see this whole thing, I think, play out in less than 6 months. Act number one was the American people said, no, we don't like George Bush's preemptive war policy. So when Obama tried it with Syria, the American people said no, and he had to stop. Number two was the American people said, we didn't like Clinton's deregulate the banksters policy, which was cheer-led and guided by Larry Summers. And so when Obama tried to put Summers in charge of the Fed, the American people said no, and he had to pull back from that. And the third act, the third shoe to fall, as it were, although I guess shoes don't come in sets of three, but the third act, to extend that metaphor, is going to be when President Obama comes before Congress and the American people and gives a very eloquent speech for fast-tracking the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Fast-tracking meaning that this bill drops on the floor of Congress. It cannot be amended. It cannot be even, you know, really seriously debated because it can't be amended. And they have to pass it by an up or down vote. And even though it's a treaty, because it involves foreign countries, it's going to be considered a trade agreement instead. And so it doesn't even require a two-thirds requirement to pass like the Constitution requires for treaties. It'll be able to pass by a simple majority. The president's going to try and do that. And I predict the American people are going to say no. What do you think?
I do, too. If people like you keep educating the people about the complexities of these dimensional quantitative proposals.
I don't even think it's that complex, Armin. I think it's really simple. Do you want to be competing in the labor market with somebody in another country who makes 35 cents an hour or 35 cents a day? Or would you rather be competing with the guy in the next town over who makes the same wage you do and you have to compete based on your skill level? You know, it's that simple. We need to get out of these stupid trade agreements. Armin, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And not just get out of these insane trade agreements, but start passing laws like, you know, raise the minimum wage and say to people like Walmart, you know, you got to pay a decent living. Okay, so this week, the Republicans in the House of Representatives, I mean, you know, they've been naming post offices and voting to end Obamacare, but they've got a vote coming up on food stamps. And they want to throw 4 to 6 million people, many of them children, off food stamps. In a time when 40% of America is living below the poverty level, people are hungry, jobs are, you know, decent jobs are pretty much non-existent. Just all this terrible stuff, all these horrible consequences of 32 years of Reaganomics. And make no mistake about it, you know, Bill Clinton did some marvelous things. He was such a better president than Bob Dole would have been or the George Herbert Walker Bush would have been. I mean, there's just no doubt in my mind about that. And probably a better president than Ross Perot would have been. Certainly more thoughtful on things like foreign policy. But Bill Clinton did not reverse Reaganomics. Ronald Reagan actually instituted a revolution. When they say the Reagan Revolution, they're talking a real revolution. There was the revolution of 1920. It was the Harding Revolution, which led to the Great Crash. Then there was the FDR Revolution called the New Deal. The New Deal stood until 1980, and it was taken down by the Reagan Revolution. And we are still operating under Reaganomics. And the way that you will know when we're no longer operating under Reaganomics, and I'll give you just a couple of three simple metrics that the era of Reaganomics is dead. These are the three things to look for. Number one, when the top tax rate on people making more than $3 million a year goes above 50%. That's number one, because that will immediately slow down the churn, the froth in the financial markets. All the gambling, all the hot money. Because whenever the top tax rate is over 3%, America has a stable economy. We did from World War II until 1983. You have a stable economy. When the top tax rate goes below 50%, the economy gets very, very unstable because rich people have all kinds of money and start playing with it, start gambling with it. So number one, when the top tax rate goes up. Number two, when we change our trade policies so that the importation of goods from low-wage countries has, there's a couple of ways to accomplish this, has attached to it a fee, a tariff, a tax, whether it's a value-added tax or a tariff, depending on how you put it together, that says you just can't import this stuff, you know, so that American workers are having to compete with foreign workers. Or American companies are having to compete with foreign companies that don't have the same environmental rules or the same labor standards. So, taxes, trade. You know, there's actually, pardon? Yeah. Well, there's several other things that you could add in there. One would be that the banks... the one I was originally thinking of was that you would see that the Sherman Antitrust Act is being enforced again. As I'm talking, I'm going through all the damage that Reagan has done, and it's kind of hard to quantify it. But I think the third big one, is you will see the deconsolidation of business in America. Right now, there is not a single major industry in America that is not controlled by fewer than five companies. And it used to be 30, 40, 50 companies would compete in major industries. And so, because we used to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act. So when small business returns to Main Street, I'm starting to make the list in my head, you know, okay, when labor unions return, you know, when the minimum wage goes up, when taxes go up on the bridge, you go through the list of things that Reaganomics, the ways that Reaganomics have devastated this country. Anyhow, that's
there. You go again.
Yes, thank you, Ronnie. Thank you. Okay, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to say the political fallout from NAFTA is really interesting too, and I think it kind of goes under the radar. And the way it works is a business, say, in the United States that wants to do business in Canada and say they're making a product that is very polluting and there's a local ordinance in one province, they can turn around and sue that province for the amount of money that they lose in profits. And so, you know, it's inherently undemocratic, a lot of these agreements. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. In Mexico, waste management dumped a bunch of literally crap or trash in one county, and it was polluting their water supply. So they passed a law that they couldn't do that. And, of course, the waste management went to NAFTA, and they had it overturned because, you know, being a poor country, they could not afford to pay that difference. And so this is that. I mean, it's just amazing. It's just undemocratic. Everything is behind closed doors. And, you know, frankly, I do blame Bill Clinton for that. And I think he was well aware of what was going on at the time when NAFTA went through. Wall Street was just salivating. I mean, I think Bill Moyers interviewed one lawyer that was representing some group on Wall Street. And the arrogance of this man was just colossal. And the fact that he didn't seem to even care if he looked arrogant. And this is what we've inherited. So, it's just amazing. I mean, it's not good for our own politic. We can't. We don't have the freedom and the ability to pass laws that we would want to against companies that might, you know, potentially harm us. And
it's like the banality of certainty. But there was, I mean, you know, during the Reagan era, when Reagan rolled out the Lafler curve and supply side economics and all that, and there were, you know, there were shills for it, and obviously. But there were also a lot of people who actually thought, I mean, David Stockman writes about this in his autobiography, and it's very thoughtful and very reflective. There were people who actually thought, maybe this will work. Maybe, you know, if we cut taxes on rich people, they'll use that money to build factories and they'll increase investment. It'll just kind of speed up the rate of the velocity of money in this country, and somehow that'll be a good thing. Without realizing that that's the definition of a bubble. But, you know, so it may be that Reagan actually believed that he was doing good and that Clinton actually believed that he was doing good. But that's a debate we're going to have another time. I'm willing to give them both, frankly, the benefit of the doubt. I don't think most people can go to bed at night thinking, hey, we just screwed a million people, sleep well. I think that they all figured out how to have people singing to them, you know, a choir singing to them, telling them that they were doing the right thing. But now it's been 32 years. We've watched these policies. And we've watched them not only in the United States, but in dozens of other countries. And what we've seen over and over and over again consistently is that the policies of Franklin Roosevelt, when they're implemented, work and build a middle class. Now, they don't work for the billionaires. The billionaires are fine. I mean, they get rich, but they don't get as rich as like David Koch does now. But the policies of FDR work. The policies of Reaganomics, whether it's implemented by a Democrat or a Republican, whether it's implemented by Obama and Clinton, or whether it's implemented by Bush and Reagan, don't work. And that's what we know today. And that's the message that we have to share with everybody else. George in San Bernardino. Hey, George.
Yes, Tom. I want to ask you, what is it they are praising Reagan like he's all this icon that he did so much for America, when all he did was really cheer up the world? All he did was let go of the oligarchs in America.
Right.
So they could,
why do Republicans praise Reagan so much and so consistently? I think for a couple of reasons. One, he actually did create a political revolution. He changed the direction of America. America was going in the direction of Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, the northern European countries that are doing so very well right now. And we were heading down that road, and he just veered us off. And so, you know, they view him as a revolutionary. And I think also there's something to be said for temperament. Temperament is, and thank you for the call, George, temperament is this thing that underlies personality. I am convinced that temperament is genetic, that we are born with it. Not genetic like, you know, there's some races that have certain temperaments, right? That kind of nonsense. But that it is something that we get from our parents. And, you know, and I'm convinced of this from being a parent, from seeing this in my own three children, from watching the rest of my members of my family, my brothers, their kids, my parents, my grandparents that I knew. I mean, you just see this. Oh, yeah, your temperament might, you know, this temperament is just like that relative, and this temperament is just like that relative. Reagan and what I've seen with my own children is that who they were when they were born, I mean, literally when they were born, is who they are in their 30s. And that's what my mom used to tell me about, you know, raising four boys, was that, you know, hey, you guys, you've always been who you've always been. I think that Reagan's core temperament was optimistic. And America actually needed that at that time. And so we loved it. You know, no matter what he said, well, we're going to invade Grenada. Oh, yes. He said it with a smile. It's going to be a marvelous thing. We're going to free them, don't you know? I mean, he might not have had a clue what he was talking about, but he was optimistic about it. And I think that temperament is something that is just sorely needed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Jimmy Carter's temperament was more introspective and thoughtful. And the America, you know, the country didn't quite so much like that. Obama's got a pretty sunny temperament, it seems. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's charity, GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of your goat and the slave, the person, the rescued former slave that you helped. Hi, how are you, Victoria?
I'm very well, Tom. Thank you very much.
It's nice to see you. So what's going on in the world?
Well, we now have a figure of at least 13 killed in the Washington Navy Yard shooting rampage early this morning, including the suspect, one of the suspected gunmen. I say one because there could be two. There could be one other man on the loose at this point in Washington, D.C. Others were injured in the shooting spree at the U.S. Navy Yard in Southeast Washington. They are searching for another potential shooter. The suspected dead gunman identified as 34-year-old Aaron Alexis of Fort Worth, Texas. They say he'd worked as a civilian contractor for the military, and he did have some connection with the Navy, and he may have used another person's badge to gain access to the Navy Yard.
Interesting. Any idea what his motivation was, what provoked this?
No, they've got no idea so far, or at least they are not giving out any idea of what the shooter's motives may have been. Two federal officials say the dead suspect had a work history with the Navy. They're saying it did not appear that the incident had a connection to terrorism. D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray has said that they're not ruling terrorism in or out.
Right. Although one thing he did have a connection to was an AR-15.
That's our understanding, and there may have been more than one gun involved also.
The report is
many as two or three.
Right, an AR-15, a shotgun, and a semi-automatic pistol, which he might have taken from a guard or somebody else.
Correct.
And somebody did return fire, a police officer, and he shot the guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The other suspect, a black male, apparently in about his 50s, wearing an olive military-style uniform, is somewhere we don't know at this point where he is. He also opened fire, and the witnesses who talk about him say that he didn't speak. He just opened fire in various occasions.
And he killed people as well?
Yes.
The second person. Oh, that's very interesting.
Well, that's what witnesses seem to be saying. They talk about him just opening fire, yes.
He wasn't shooting at the shooter. I mean, you had the situation, I think it was yesterday, where the New York police tried to stop a guy and they shot shot a 90-year-old lady with a walker instead, you know, because...
No, we seem to be talking about two people working together here.
I see. Okay.
What do you think? That's the impression you get. President Obama, at an event today that I was at, actually it was an event primarily on the economy, but in which he did address this. This was the first item that he talked about. He was clearly very moved by this. He said that his thoughts and prayers were with those who were injured and killed. They're patriots, and they know the dangers of serving abroad. But today they face the unimaginable violence that they wouldn't have expected here at home. He also said the U.S. will thoroughly investigate what happened and hold responsible whoever carried out this cowardly act. He also opened his remarks by referring to, and I don't want to get the words wrong, but it was along the lines of saying that it was yet another, so we are confronting yet another mass shooting.
Yeah. This is the AR-15 connection, which is what Adam Lanza used in Newtown.
Indeed.
Amazing.
The bulk of the president's remarks were to be about economic recovery. Mm-hmm. Yesterday marked the 5-year anniversary of the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, which it's thought precipitated the economic financial collapse. Mm-hmm. And President Obama, in some pretty feisty remarks, and it's interesting, actually, journalists questioned Jay Carney at the briefing today whether Obama should have continued with the remarks in the light of the shooting, which I thought was interesting, kind of as though a president cannot deal with more than one important topic at the same time.
Well, the press can't.
The press can't.
So.
I think it's interesting that apparently a president can't, because the economy, of course, is life and death to many people.
Yes.
So he spoke very strongly about the economy. He accused Republicans of the height of irresponsibility for an unwillingness to compromise over the budget. I cannot remember a time when one faction of one party promises economic chaos if it can't get 100% of what it wants. That's never happened before.
It's true.
He also said, are some of these folks so beholden to one extreme wing of their party that they're willing to tank the economy? Are they really willing to hurt people just to score political points?
I think they are.
I think he felt that way, too. I got that impression. He also made it very clear that he would not negotiate over the debt ceiling.
Right. Good. Good.
So we do have a showdown looming. Also today, the UN has released the report on chemical weapons, saying that the UN has confirmed unequivocally and objectively that chemical weapons have been used in Syria.
But not by whom?
That was not the mandate of the report of the chemical weapons inspectors.
Right. Okay.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said this is a war crime. Now, people digging down into this report will probably get a sense of whether it was the government or government forces or the rebels. You can get a pretty good sense of where the rockets were fired from. Did they come from Tom Hartman's house or Victoria Jones's house?
Right. But then there's that second question, which the Germans have raised, which is, might it have been that elements within the military who had been asking al-Assad to use chemical weapons, and he'd been consistently saying no, decided to go ahead and do it either in defiance of him or even to sabotage him?
President Obama has said that regardless, Assad is responsible.
Yeah. Well, I think you can make that argument. You're president of the country, you're where the buck stops. Very interesting. Thank you very much for the call, Victoria, for the news. Great to talk
with you.
We'll be back with more. Actually, we're going to get into the climate and also, you know, what was the difference between the Reagan tax cuts and the Kennedy tax cuts? People always ask that. I'm sure the answer.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I wanted to continue. Well, we're going to talk with Tom Weiss in a few minutes, or in the next segment, actually. But I wanted to continue on this conversation. I noticed that we had a caller, actually, earlier who dropped off after sitting on hold for about a half hour. My apologies. It happens a lot, actually. But who had asked the question, what was the difference between Reagan's tax cut and Kennedy's tax cut? Because Jack Kennedy ran on in the election of 1960 on a pledge to cut taxes. And that tax cut is what was cited by Ronald Reagan. If you're old enough to remember the Reagan campaign of 1980 or the Reagan tax cuts of 83 and 86, actually, there was a series of them during that time. But the big one, I think, was 83, 84, 85, when he got below 50%. You will remember that Reagan constantly cited Kennedy. You know, Jack Kennedy did this, so I'm just going to do more of it. It worked. It stimulated the economy. So what was the difference? Well, you will find people who say the Reagan tax cut stimulated the economy. Well, how do you know that? Well, because the economy was better the year after than it was the year before. Well, here's the simple reality about that. You go all the way back to the George Washington administration, and other than during periods of time that we call depressions, every year the economy is always better than the year before, particularly if you've got a little bit of inflation. But it's better because, you know, the country grows. There's more people. There's more economy. there's greater efficiencies, business grow. I mean, you know, it's just every year things grow. So saying that the economy was better the year after the Reagan tax cuts than before proves the Reagan tax cuts did it is nonsense. The economy would have gotten better no matter what. It's like Romney, you know, it's when Romney was running for president, he came out and he said, you know, here's my plan. My plan is in the first 4 years of my administration to create 20 million jobs or 10 million. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact number. I think it might have been 10 million jobs, but whatever. He said, I'm going to create this number of jobs in the first 4 years. And the CBO came out and said, you know, it doesn't matter who's president, it doesn't matter what their policies are. The economy is going to anemically grow, perhaps, but it is going to grow by an amount that will create this amount of jobs, whether Romney does it or not. Romney had no answer to that other than maybe that's where he got the number from. I don't know. But there was a really significant difference between Jack Kennedy's tax cuts, which actually weren't Jack Kennedy's. They were Lyndon Johnson's. Kennedy proposed them in the debates in 1960. And the clip I'm going to play for you is from Jack Kennedy's debate with Richard Nixon in 1960. And he proposed them into law in 1963, and he was assassinated before they could be passed. And so Lyndon Johnson passed them in 64. So they're really LBJ's tax cuts, if you want to be technically accurate. But what it did was it lowered the top tax rate from 91% down to 74%. And the following year, tax collections went up. More money was taken in. And Reagan pointed this out. Over and over and over again. I heard, you know, I just got so sick of hearing that because I knew why the tax collections had gone up. See, Kennedy was, you know, he was from a family that in today's dollars was a billionaire or certainly a multi-millionaire. Joe Kennedy built one of the, you know, big American fortunes out of bootlegging and the stock, you know, stock market manipulation, basically the Roaring Twenties, doing all that deregulated stuff. I mean, he was kind of, Joe Kennedy was kind of the Ken Lay of his day. Only it didn't go bust, he didn't get caught, and he created a dynasty. And so Jack Kennedy, having been born into this extraordinary wealth, and being extraordinarily wealthy himself, he knew that, you know, by 1960, nobody was paying 91% income tax, even though that was top rate. Now, many people didn't pay it because they just didn't let their income go above $3 million. But a lot of people had income over $3 million and they didn't pay it because they had figured out two principal ways to avoid taxes. And the first was claiming that their income wasn't income, it was capital gains. So instead of their company paying them with income, their company would pay them with a oil painting, and then they would sell it a few years later after it appreciated, and they'd say, oh, it's a capital gain. Capital gains are taxed at a lower rate. And back then, that lower rate was well below 50%. In fact, it was, I think, around 28%. It might have been, but actually, it was below that because Reagan raised the capital gains rate up to 28% in 1983, as I recall. So the first was capital gains. Capital gains was like, this was the rich person's tax. And so Kennedy said, we're going to raise the capital gains, which was part of the Kennedy tax cut. They cut the top tax rate, but they raised the capital gains rate. And then the second was closing what he called loopholes on deductions, which were all these various business deductions that wealthy people could take, you know, their private jet, the three martini lunch, all that kind of thing. And he had a whole list of things that he wanted to close the loopholes on. And he said, and if we do these things, we'll have extra money. And with this extra money, we can build more schools. We can build more hospitals. Actually, let me let Jack Kennedy tell you. Here he is laying out his plan. First the rationale for it, then the plan.
We are in the...
Whoa, I'm sorry. That was Alan Greenspan. You don't want to hear Alan Greenspan. Here's Jack Kennedy.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding on expense accounts.
Now, notice he didn't say tax cuts, although it was a tax cut. It was from 91 to 47.4% for the very top rate. He said tax changes, because he knew that what he was proposing would increase revenues. So it really wasn't a tax cut. Rich people were going to pay more money. And what was he going to do with that money? Here's Jack Kennedy.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a...
Here, try it here.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Now, isn't it amazing? You know, Nixon, of course, was saying, oh, Kennedy, you know, Kennedy is calling for a tax cut, and you know, I'm calling for a tax cut. Let's lower the tax rates on the millionaires, quack, quack, quack. And Kennedy, just like Reagan did, Reagan lied about Kennedy's tax cuts too, or tax changes, excuse me. And so at the very end, Kennedy feels like he has to say, you know, Mr. Nixon is lying. Well, here, I think this is it right here.
Budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly.
Misstates
them. Which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Yes, and where he stood was right here saying we can increase our revenues.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion
through
tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
So he's proposing a $1 billion tax increase. Back in 1960, that's like, you know, maybe $100 billion tax increase in today's dollars. I mean, that was really significant. Back then, the minimum wage was, what, $1.50 or something like that? And, you know, now it's $7. So you could do the math. I mean, it's actually, it would be over $10 now if it was where it was back then. So here's Kennedy proposing a tax increase of over $1 billion. Nixon had been arguing for a tax cut, saying that Kennedy was in favor of a tax cut. Kennedy says Nixon's lying. And then the next generation, Reagan, comes along and he lies about what Kennedy did. And to this day, you have conservatives saying, well, Jack Kennedy cut taxes and it raised the income to the government. No, he didn't cut taxes. He proposed raising taxes. He cut the top rate, but he raised the tax base. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As Abe Lincoln said, figures don't lie, but liars sure can figure. Media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and welcome back. In the first hour of our program, we went through a fairly lengthy, and it's worth revisiting, you know, how this economic crash came about. And it came about basically, I mean, you know, at a simple core, as the result of the Reagan Revolution. Reaganomics, which we have been operating under and within since 1980, 81. Really was a revolution. It really was the repudiation of New Deal economics, which had started in 1933. It was the repudiation and the systematic dismantling of that. And the farther along we get, the deeper we get into Reaganomics, the more we see Reaganomics be deconstructed, being taken apart, and the more we see the economy falling apart along with it. So I want to get into that, and I will in just a moment. But first, Tom Weiss is with us. He is the president of Climate Crisis Solutions. ClimateCrisisSolutions.com is the website. And, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
I understand you're based in Boulder?
I am.
So we had a report earlier on from a news reporter there from KZZN. Tom Campbell was his name? Jerry Bell was telling us about it, and it was a pretty grim picture. What's the connection to this 1,000-year flood that Denver just had, or that the central Colorado had, and climate change, if any?
Well, I think the connection is quite clear. We have obviously changed the climate to such a degree that I think all bets are off in terms of what we can expect from the weather. And, you know, and I think the best way to describe that is weather weirding. And that's what we're experiencing. And, I mean, Tom, last year, last summer, from where I am right now, I looked out and I watched a wildfire make its way towards the National Center for Atmospheric Research overlooking Boulder. I never thought I would see that in my lifetime. I mean, that's where they study global weirding and weather weirding. And, you know, and then here we are a year later, and I'm in that same yard, and I'm looking out, and a suburban street is running like a river.
Hmm.
And it's unbelievable. I mean, almost every home in the neighborhood that I'm in right now has hoses, pumping out the water from their homes.
Wow.
I mean, this is what we've got to look forward to.
Yeah, we've got 5% more moisture in the atmosphere, so surprise. The atmosphere is more unstable, and B, when it dumps moisture, it's got 5% more. What do you expect?
Right. And if we don't take action immediately, things are just going to get increasingly worse.
Yeah. And in the larger sense, are you familiar with with any of the five great mass extinctions that the Earth has experienced, and how there was an associated component of global climate change and sudden methane releases associated with them?
Sure.
You want to riff on that at all? Because this has got me freaked. I mean, when the Arctic goes ice free, there's 2 trillion tons of methane in the Arctic tundra, the Arctic permafrost, and in as methane clathrates, methane hydrate crystals under the sea that are largely stabilized by that ice. And when that goes, I mean, we could be looking at a mass extinction, not just flooding in Denver.
Well, you're right, Tom. And I mean, what we're looking at is the question of whether we're going to continue to live here on this planet.
Yeah.
Not only our species, but all the other species that we share this planet with. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the methane releases and the permafrost and, you know, I mean, what if the thermohaline, circulation of the ocean shuts down?
Right.
What if that happens?
Europe goes into an ice age.
There's so many tipping points that, you know, we may have already reached, but we can only hope that some of them we have not, and we can still turn things around and make things at least livable for future generations. But, that's going to take heroic efforts, and we're not seeing anything coming out of the White House that even comes close to what
well,
we need.
And it's not just the White House. I mean, you're not seeing it come out of Congress. You're not seeing it come out of state legislatures.
Oh, yeah.
You know, other nations.
Right down the list, Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, politicians in general.
Yeah. I think it's time for us to start shifting the conversation from losing Miami to losing the human species to talking about extinction. What do you think?
I agree with you.
Do you know of any mainstream climate organizations that are willing to go there? I've not been able to find any.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have these conversations with these folks all the time, and I say, you know, because I've been studying the Permian mass extinction. And it was, you know, the first third of the extinction was significant, but it really got under steam when the oceans warmed up 5 degrees and there was 6 degrees, and there was this sudden release of methane from the oceans, and that doubled the rate of global warming, and that killed off 95% of all life on Earth. And I mean, there's, you know, you go back and you talk to the geologists, and they all know this. Climate scientists don't know about, you know, the deep geologic past. And I just, you know, I'm not finding groups that want to talk about this. The IPCC, you know, the study that they've got coming out in 2 weeks, it's not going to talk about methane release because it's you know, the science is in flux, in quotes. Your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing up methane, Tom, because, I mean, over the first 20 years that it's in the atmosphere, I believe the number is either 72 or 75 times as potent.
Yeah.
A greenhouse gas as CO2.
Yeah, it is.
So it's somewhere in the 70s. This is an extreme situation that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I'm with you. Tom Weiss, president of Climate Crisis Solutions. ClimateCrisisSolutions.com. Is it .com or .org, Tom?
It's .org or .com.
.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
ClimateCrisisSolutions.com. Tom Weiss. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the report from Boulder.
And Tom, maybe get a hold of Ted Turner. He'll be happy to talk about the extension.
I'll do it. The good, the bad, and the very, very masticophorically ugly, the good. Barney Frank. During an appearance on Meet the Press Sunday, the former Massachusetts congressman lit into his fellow guest, CNBC host analyst Maria Bartiromo, after she said it's time to stop talking about how evil Wall Street is. Take a look.
I do want to add one thing, though, to your question about those poor, beleaguered bankers who have been forced to do so much to keep from not being able to pay their debts that they can't lend money. If they really are running businesses that are so stressed that they can't do their basic work, why are they paying themselves so much money? Where did these enormous salaries come from if they were, in fact, in such serious trouble?
And nobody had an answer. Former Congressman Frank is spot on. 5 years after the collapse of 2008, Wall Street banksters are still raking in billions. When you consider that all they're really doing is glorified gambling, it's time to have a serious conversation about what value they actually add to our economy. The bad. Eric Erickson. On a recent appearance on Fox News, the conservative pundit told host Neil Cavuto that congressional Republicans should stick to their promises and defund Obamacare because, according to him, it's the right thing to do.
You've got dozens and dozens of Republicans who ran into office and got elected saying they were going to do every single thing they could to stop Obamacare. They have a choice now, right now, to defund it. And now they're saying, oh, well, we can't do that because we might get blamed for a shutdown. So what? It's the right thing to do.
Actually, shutting down the government to defund Obamacare or anything else is not the right thing to do. Even if you do think preventing tens of millions of Americans from getting health care is okay, which is not. Shutting down the government would have untold disastrous effects on the rest of the economy and the world. The fact is that this is the major policy plan of a big section of the Republican Party right now, and that is a very sad sign of how far that party has fallen and how little it cares about the average working American person. And the very, very ugly Keith Abloh. On the September 13th episode of America's Newsroom, the conservative commentator argued that guns have nothing to do with gun violence and instead blamed mass shootings on violent video games. Seriously, listen.
It's maddening, frankly, because guns are irrelevant to this problem. We're exposing people most at risk to a new and toxic drug called virtual entertainment.
Yeah. Actually, numerous studies have found that there is no conclusive evidence about the influence of violent video games on mass shootings. On the other hand, there's plenty of evidence that easy access to firearms does have an impact on mass shootings. In fact, a recent Mother Jones study found that of the 143 weapons used in mass shootings between 1982 and 2012, 48 of them would have been outlawed by the assault weapons ban proposed in the Senate earlier this year. In light of today's tragedy in Washington, D.C., it's hard to see Keith Abloh's misinformation as anything but very, very ugly.
Mind-bogglingly ugly.
So, where was I? Oh, yeah, I wanted to share with you this clip of Alan Greenspan. See, this is part I'm trying to explain. How did we get into this thing, right? How did we get here, this economic disaster? And, yeah, Reaganomics, easy answer. But the core foundation of Reaganomics comes out of libertarianism, which was founded in 1946 by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as a way of giving a philosophical and political rationale to letting businesses run the government, basically to fascism. And objectivism, which was Ayn Rand's personal variation of the same thing, which was that, you know, the billionaires in the marketplace will always do the right thing and workers are stupid and shouldn't have any say in things. and that democracy is a bad thing. Objectivists and libertarians do not believe in democracy. And that's not a slur. It's simply a simple statement of fact. Some of them will proudly proclaim that. So Alan Greenspan was such an objectivist, such a follower. He had been inaugurated, or whatever the word is, initiated into Ayn Rand's cult in New York City back in the 1950s. I think it was 56. When she died, he brought a wreath of flowers shaped like a dollar sign to her funeral. This is how much of an acolyte of Ayn Rand that Alan Greenspan was. And he absolutely believed that when counterparties is the economic word for the two people in a economic transaction, buyer and seller, that when counterparties saw bad behavior, that they would immediately change their behavior. His philosophy was that the government had no business whatsoever regulating banks, because if the banks behaved badly, people wouldn't want to work with them and they'd go out of business. That the market would automatically and naturally fix itself. The magic of the marketplace. And when the crash happened in 2008, which was clearly driven not by any legislation that Jimmy Carter ever proposed, but by banksters, because for 70 years we'd had this very stable mortgage market. There was a predictable number of mortgages out there. And the Commodity Futures Trading Act allowed bankers to start creating a brand new product called derivatives, but they had to have an underlying value to derive from, which was a mortgage. So with a single mortgage, a couple $100,000 mortgage on a house, they could create tens of millions of dollars in profits with these derivatives. But they had to have the mortgage. So they started, and so Greenspan basically deregulated the banks. He said, you know, we're going to ignore the oversight. Ted Geithner was head of the New York Fed, which oversaw the banks in New York City. And he said, hands over my eyes, thumbs in my ears, hands over my mouth. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. And so the banks, there was such a demand for mortgages because the banks could turn these into derivatives, into trillions of dollars of derivatives. They needed billions of dollars worth of mortgages. And the mortgage market was stable. And so they had to create mortgages out of thin air. And so they basically said to the loan originators, to the countrywides of the world, just loan to anybody. I don't care. Loan to anybody. I just need the mortgage. I'll pay you a commission off the top. You know, I'll buy the mortgage from you the day after you originate it. So you don't have to worry about the fact that the guy that you just gave that mortgage to, there's no way he can pay it back. We'll take the risk because we're going to make millions of dollars on this $100,000 mortgage. So if this mortgage goes bad, we'll just pay it off. It's no problem. This is really how it happened. And when it crashed, what had happened was the banksters has taken so much of that money out of the system that they couldn't pay those mortgages back. Or they wouldn't. Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein, they didn't want to give back their $100 million, their $10 million, $5 million, whatever. They didn't want to give back their multi-million dollar paychecks. And so instead they went to our government hat in hand, and George Bush wrote them a check for $700 billion. $700 billion. So anyhow, here's what Alan Greenspan had to say. Now that you know what the word counterparties means, this will probably make a little more sense. Just listen to this. It's pretty amazing.
As I wrote last March, those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity.
Now let me translate that. The self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity. In other words, the banks are not going to behave badly and thus hurt their stockholders, because they want their reputations to remain intact. Okay, that's what he meant by that.
To protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief.
Shocked disbelief. And then he goes on to say it apparently doesn't work. Everything that I've based my whole entire life on apparently is a lie.
Such counterparty surveillance is a central pillar of our financial market state of balance. If it fails, as occurred this year, market stability is undermined.
Got it? If this counterparty balance, so the whole, in other words, basically what he said was Reaganomics, objectivism, libertarianism, it's a crock. And then he said, and by the way, I don't want to be the chairman of the Fed anymore. I'm done with this gig. I'm out of here. And that's where he went. So, anyhow, Bill in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to KABQ. Hey, Bill, we got a minute to the break. It's yours.
Okay. Time magazine, right in line with what you're saying, they have about 12 pages devoted to how Wall Street won 5 years after the crash could happen all over again. Mm-hmm. And they really analyze these things in a readable way. Even including that the banks hire private bank examiners to okay their books.
Right.
Oversight for Hire is the title of that article.
Yeah.
It's really great because it goes over just what you were talking about, plus, you know, and it gives some answers what this, you know, they really look into it, and I'm so glad that Time Magazine, which is a middle of the road, you know, it's
yeah.
But they've come out for honesty and for the people.
That's pretty impressive. I'll have to check that out, Bill. I saw an article in Salon, and I saw an article in The Atlantic along the same lines. I mean, everybody's kind of doing these five-year anniversary articles. But, yeah, it is absolutely the case. I mean, these banksters have robbed us blind. They all got away with it. They got the money. Nobody went to jail. They're sitting fat and happy. They're laughing at us, and they don't give a rat's patootie about the middle class in America, and that's the tragedy. Bill, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And on top of that, because of the Supreme Court giving us Citizens United, the banksters have this wholly owned subsidiary called the United States Congress. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We've covered a lot of territory today, from global warming to Reaganomics to, you know, why the economy is bad to President Obama's speech about the economy. And how, in my opinion, you know, I get it. You know, he inherited a disaster and free fall, and all he's been able to get the Republicans in Congress to go along with is a little bit of baling wire and sheetrock, when what he needs to be doing is building the Hoover Dam, you know. But end of sentence. Mark in Niles, Illinois. Hey, Mark, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again. I just had a comment about that I know you are a big proponent of words have meaning, and I'd like to see you refer to global warming as global heating, because global warming, who doesn't like to be warm? It sounds comforting.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say global heating, it implies...
How about calling it global burning?
Yep.
Global extinction.
Yep. Well, I always like to keep in mind George Carlin's line that... the Earth doesn't care if we're on it or not.
Right.
So, you know,
yeah, the Earth's going to be just fine with that. You know, it's the human race that has to worry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really, really good riff. Mark, thanks a lot. That's a good suggestion. I appreciate it. Paula in Pinellas Park, Florida. Hey, Paula.
Hey. Hey, Tom. I was wondering if you were aware that yesterday on Ring of Fire, Mike Papantonio had on Greg Palast, and he was talking about a memo he got from Timmy Geithner to...
No, I was unaware of this. Tell
Summers.
Me.
And then I read my email last night, and I had a thing on there from Ezra Klein, wrote a whole thing, article about Larry Summers, and on the end of it was the memo that
okay.
Greg Palast was talking about.
And what did the memo say?
It was about... as we enter the end game of the WTO financial services negotiations, and it gives names of banks for Larry Summers to contact.
Whoa.
So I was wondering if that wasn't why he withdrew his nomination.
Because Ezra Klein just outed him over the weekend, you mean?
Yep.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'm going to have to look that up. Oh, is that in the Washington Post?
No, it was on Daily Kos.
Huh. Very, very interesting. I wonder how I missed that. I check the Daily Coast fairly frequently. Paula, thanks for the heads up on that.
No problem.
Appreciate the call. Mike in Bemidji. How do you say that in Minnesota there, Mike?
Bemidji.
Okay. Close
yeah,
enough.
It's B-E-M-I-D-J. Well, I was just going to, on this bankster deal, isn't it awful funny how the Congress and everybody signed into law and changed all of the declaring bankruptcy laws for people but not corporations?
Yes. Yes. Like if you've got student loans now, you cannot discharge them in bankruptcy. But if you're a corporation, you can discharge anything in bankruptcy.
Absolutely. And it was all done just before all this stuff started happening.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think it was 2004, 2005 that bankruptcy law came down. And I had a Democratic United States senator on this program, and I just gave that senator hell for voting for this bankruptcy law. And that person has not yet come back on this program, to the best of my knowledge, I think because of that, which is fine. But I was saying at the time, it's just not fair to say students can't discharge things in bankruptcy to raise the bar higher for bankruptcy. And the argument was, oh, you know, but our banks need this. You know, they need to be protected. And I'm like, yeah, the banks 10 times larger than they were when Reagan came into office. They don't need to be. Banks are infrastructure for this country. You know, it's you get commerce, you get produce from Chicago to New York City by truck on a highway. The highway is the infrastructure. You get the payment for that produce from New York City back to Chicago via a bank. They're just infrastructure. They shouldn't be, you know, mind-boggling profit centers. I mean, to take it to the metaphor of the roads, it would be the equivalent of, you know, if what the banksters have done is the equivalent of setting up toll booths on the roads and saying, we're going to charge whatever the market will bear. So, you know, hey, it's $10 today, it's $20 tomorrow, it's $300 a day after that to just go down this road because we own the infrastructure. And that's a really dangerous thing. Mike, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Janet in Flushing, New York. Hey, Janet, what's on your mind today?
Hey, you know what's on my mind? Fracking.
Yeah?
I have a house in upstate New York, and that's all they talk about up there. But I live in New York City in Flushing, and no one in Flushing knows what fracking is.
Really?
And I can't understand why none of the news people are talking about it, but yet they want to frack.
Well, the reason the news people don't talk about it, Paul or Janet, watch your TV and you will see these lovely little ads for natural gas. And look at this well. It looks like children can play around it. Their money is coming from fracking. They're advertising.
They're going to poison all our water in New York City. Because they're going to frack the Marcellus Shale from the watershed that New York City gets all its water from.
I thought New York City got its water from the Hudson River.
Yeah, none of the people here are even aware of what fracking is.
Yeah. How does fracking contaminate the Hudson River?
No one's aware of it in the city.
Yeah. Okay,
so city, you say fracking, they don't know what you're talking about.
Right. But I
can't understand how this issue can be let go so easily.
But here's a question, Janet. Fracking, I know, contaminates underwater water. How does it contaminate groundwater water, like river water?
Okay, it does that because they're using over 500 chemicals to frack.
Uh-huh.
And that the water that they're using with these chemicals will wash into the watershed.
End up in the river.
Water into the beds of the water that's coming down.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Makes perfect sense. Janet, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back tomorrow. And, you know, with all the news and information on the latest mass shooting, plus what's going on in California, could Siskiyou become Jefferson, America's 51st state? We'll talk with Siskiyou County Commissioner Brandon Chris. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It genuinely does begin with you. Tag your it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.